Well, fall is officially here, and it actually feels kind of like fall out there. So we felt it another good time for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and we invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Dr. Burden, welcome back to our show again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So each month we've decided here at What's Bugging You to go with a profile insect or a profile topic. And what do you have for us this month?
Well, a few days ago, I was putting gas in my car, and I noticed love bugs. So it's love bug season again. They are a semi-annual nuisance. They're also known as the honeymoon fly or the double-headed fly. They are true flies in the fact that each adult only has one pair of wings. In other parts of the country, they may be known as the two-headed fly, because during copulation, there's one head on one side, another head on the other side, or sometimes they're actually known as honeymoon flies as well. Now, we've had a very relatively mild summer, very wet summer here, and those are ideal conditions for the love bugs. The larvae like to feed on decaying vegetation, and it has to be moist decaying vegetation, and it has been moist in many parts. The adults will feed on nectar of many of the common weeds that we have around here. Pretty soon the goldenrods will be blooming if they haven't already, and they especially like to feed on the nectar of goldenrods. Now, one of the problems that we have with love bugs is, one, they're not known to transmit any disease, so they're not disease-causing organisms. And since they just feed on nectar, they're not going to be plant pests. But they are attracted to light-colored surfaces. They are attracted to car fumes. We don't know why, but they are. And so we find them a lot in our cars, on our cars. And then when we're driving down the highway or down the road, if the numbers are large enough so that they're very dense, the car will smash them. And their insides, especially after they die, tend to be very acidic, around a 4.5 acidic range. That would be like tomato juice is acidic, coffee is acidic about that time. The female can lay up to 100 to 350 eggs at a time. And it takes 3 months for the larvae to develop. And that's why we have two generations a year. We'll have a spring generation, and we'll have a fall generation, which is the generation that we're experiencing right now. And, of course, the males will hatch first, and then they will wait around for the females to hatch. And as soon as the female hatches, the males will latch on to the female, and they will stay copulation anywhere from 2 to 3 days. And so that's why it's very, very common to see them attached to each other, the males attached to the female. And so the bottom line is that they're here to stay. We're not going to get rid of the love bugs. Even if we had Bill Gates' money, I don't think we would be able to do that. Malaria is much more important, but we just have to tolerate them. And if you do have a significant number on your car, rinse them off with water, because you don't want that acidic nature to pit the paint, to cause little pits to occur in the paint of your car. And that's pretty much all you and everything you would ever want to know about love bugs.
It's too bad we can't find a way of harvesting them and using them usefully, because there are millions of them out there, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, are welcome. And in the meantime, while we're waiting for your phone calls to come in, and we do have all lines open right now, folks, so you can get right in, we have a lot of photographs that have been sent to us over the past month, starting with Aaron from Vivian, who sent us a whole slew of different photographs of different insects. And we've got a bunch of these up. Let's start out from the top and talk about, she had written in and says, "Hi, I'm Aaron from Vivian, Louisiana. The two hanging cocoons that you can see on our website, folks, these pictures are up on our website. Just go to redriverradio.org and click on the What's Bugging You post for this month and go ahead and open that up, and you'll see all these pictures if you scroll down. She says, the two hanging cocoons are beside the giant white and black spider, and I was wondering if these were her eggs. The spider is at least 3 inches long, and I suppose the big red and black creature is the female wasp." That's another picture that she sent. And let's go with the spiders first. What kind of a spider is this?
It's in the orb weaver family. Sometimes they'll go often by the nickname of a garden spider, because you see them a lot in the gardens of people, and they will make that characteristic zigzag line down through the center of their web. And there's been a lot of speculation on what that's for, but those are egg, if you want to call them cocoons. Cocoons are normally, the word cocoon is normally reserved for the transition between the larval stage and the adult stage of spiders and insects. We would prefer that those be called egg sacs. That would be the more common name for them. And they're very, they're round about the size of a large gumball, and tannish in nature. And they're actually very, very beneficial arthropods to have around your house and in the garden, because they do trap a lot of pest insects and eat them. And so if you can, just leave them alone and let them be a part of your urban ecosystem.
Now, in Florida, we called those, not this particular kind, but the big yellow ones.
Yeah.
We called them banana spiders, because they were about the size of a banana, and you would find them in the, you know, if a lot of people grow bananas in Florida. So if you grew bananas, you would find them in your banana fields or, you know, in your banana tree.
Right. They, it's there's several varieties, but the black and white and the yellow black and white do tend to be the ones that a lot of people see and depend upon.
Right. And we're going to go down now. She had mentioned this one, a red and black insect, and she thought it was the a wasp, but that is actually not a wasp, is it not?
No, it's not. And what's interesting about this, we got another thing about this particular insect. They're called velvet ants. And somebody said that they run very fast, and she described them to me in her email. I think I forwarded that email on to you, Bill.
Yes.
And I went online, and I got a picture of a velvet ant, and I sent it to her, and I said, did it look like this? And I wish I could see these people when they go, oh yes,
right.
That's it. And so they're actually wingless female wasp. The males are winged, the females are not. And that's the one that was sent in by Elizabeth. And so they have a very, very strong stinger. I urge you not to mess with these things, and they're not aggressive. They're just down there hunting for food, and they also have an extremely, extremely hard exoskeleton. You almost, if you try to crush them with your shoes while they're on soil, then they'll just get up and walk away. You kind of have to get them up on the concrete and put a little pressure. Not that I'm telling you to go out and kill these things. I'm just saying that that's how hard of an exoskeleton they have. There's a lot of other insects that have very, very hard exoskeleton, but they're up there in the top.
It's very interesting, and she sent in a fairly good picture of that one. Now, she also sent in these two pictures here, which actually I think are the same. I think I have duplicates up there. But this is some kind of a leaf or something that is just covered with all kinds of little critters that almost look like they're in cocoons.
Actually, they're not. Those are some type of an immature, what we call an immature true bug. They belong in the same group, the same order as stink bugs do. These particular ones look like they're probably fairly large, and some of the largest ones are in the family known as assassin bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But not all of them take blood meals like an assassin bug would. Most of them feed on plants, and they're really very much like mosquitoes, that they're just, look how they're sucking that plant dry, and you
right.
can actually see on the edges where it's brown and curled in.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I know they're immatures is because you can see the segmentation of their abdomen all the way up to their thorax. But if they had wings, then the wings would be covering that segmentation, and you wouldn't be able to see it.
Oh, I got you.
And so normally, any good pyrethrin insecticide would take care of those, but obviously not if you all let the population get that high.
Right.
And so people that garden tend to be very, very observant, and they know when they see one, maybe not bad, but if they start to see four or five, then it's time to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting critter, also sent from Aaron. It almost looks like a crab.
Well, it is called a crab spider, and that's because those front legs are curled out, kind of look like crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting enough, they also walk sideways like crabs.
Oh.
And so that's one of the few arthropods that had that particular type of behavior that can actually do that. And it's kind of unusual to see a light green one on a dark green leaf, because normally they will choose vegetation and leaves that they can blend into.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're called ambush predators, and so they blend in and they hide. And then when an insect walks by that they feel like it would be good prey, a prey item, then they ambush them and attack.
Interesting. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and we have phone lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got more pictures, but we're going to get to some phone calls here real quick. And first up is John from Fishville. John, you are on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Well, it's kind of a, let's get back to the love bug program there. We just finished a gazebo and just finished screening it in with still one door open, and it filled up with these love bugs. I mean, I've never seen such a collection of insects in my life. And I said, well, that's fine. We'll stock them in, close the door in here, and I'll feed them to my chickens. And one of the ladies said, oh, no, no, they are just no protein at all in that bug. Now, I don't know where she got that, but is there anything to that?
Just the opposite, actually, John. Insects are known to be high in protein, and people in certain parts of the world mass raise crickets and grind up crickets to for them to be added into bird feed and for the food of other animals as well. And so I would certainly turn my chickens loose on them and say bon appetit.
Yeah,
and
I did some soldier flies here a year or two ago, and oh wow, that's a high protein. I guarantee you, those hens just thrived on them. So
it's interesting that you say that you just built the gazebo, because that's one thing I didn't mention. I mentioned that they were attracted to automobile fumes and white colored surfaces, but they're also attracted to fresh paint.
Oh, that explains that.
Yep, I think that's the best explanation. And so you never know. That's why I love doing this show, because you never know when a caller is going to call in and tell you something as just a mere observance when it happens to be the key to the question.
Yeah. Well, that does explain a lot, because while we were out there for a few days doing the gazebo, it was just love bug crazy. I never saw such a collection. Okay, that explains that. Now I'll be the smart guy of the family.
There you go.
Thanks, John. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Max from El Dorado, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Well, I've got a little formal garden behind my house, and I like to encourage the nice critters like ladybugs and chameleons and us, but the skinks are driving me crazy. I hate a skink. And I know it's not a bug, but they sure are bugging me. Do you know anything about a skink, and how can I get rid of them?
I don't. You've got me on that one, but you might try skinks in the reptile world tends to have a little bit softer body than some of the other lizards do. At least that's always seemed like to me. And so you might try putting down some dichotomous earth, and so they would have to crawl across that. And it may be enough of an irritant to keep them out of your garden. So I would just put a ring of dichotomous earth around your garden if that's feasible for you to do so. If it's not feasible, then you might just select a couple plants and put it around there. And that way you can basically have a controlled experiment. Plants without dichotomous earth, plants with dichotomous earth. And so you'll find out if that perhaps is that way. Or not.
They hang around outside the porch light and stuff at night, and I guess they're eating other bugs.
Yeah, absolutely. They're insect eaters.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they come in if you let them. Oh, they're home light.
Well, I can tell you this. In Florida, those are actually prized because they eat insects, and those and geckos will get rid of a lot of insect problems around the area. So outside in particular, now inside, obviously, you don't want them, you know, crawling around on you. But outside, I would leave them alone just because they're going to eat the mosquitoes and other things.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Max.
Right. Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. A familiar voice is on the line next from Nacogdoches, Cliff Shackelford. Hi, Cliff. How are you?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm always a big fan of Dr. Burton's, and I have a bird insect question for her.
You got a bird that's going to eat the love bugs?
Well, we know so many of our birds are insectivorous, and there has been this viral incident or event in New Mexico, I don't know if she's heard about, where lots and lots of birds were found dead in that cold snap that hit September 8th and 9th.
Mm-hmm. I did see those headlines. Yes, I did.
Yeah, and so I'm constantly asked to comment on that, and when it's an insectivorous bird and it's cold temperatures and those birds have been in cold temperature for days, it's pretty obvious that, you know, poor body condition and starvation was to blame. So, but my question is, what does it take for temperature? What kind of temperature does it take to rise enough for insects to start flying again and for them to start being alert where birds can start feeding again? So what's the lowest ambient temperature that can happen for bugs to start flying again?
My guess, and that's a really cool question. My guess, it would be probably somewhere in the mid 60s degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
But some insects, especially bumblebees, have a very unique behavior where they will flex their flight muscles. And the flexing of those flight muscles will generate enough heat for them to be able to take off and fly. Not all insects do that, but insects are what we call poikilothermic animals, and that's something that you're a vertebrate guy, a bird guy, and I'm an invertebrate person, and that is, you know, we never use the term cold-blooded and warm-blooded anymore.
No,
those are archaic terms.
That's right.
And so we either use endothermic or exothermic on whether they generate their heat internally or externally. But insects will take on the ambient temperature. That's why we call them poikilothermic organisms. And there's been a whole – one of the most popular books in is called Bumblebee Economics by Bern Heinrich. And I believe I got that right. And there's a lot of people that says that physically bumblebees shouldn't be able to fly, but he did a lot of thermal regulation with bumblebees and determined, well, of course they can fly. We see them flying everywhere. And so, you know, that's what the physicists do. But don't get me started on the physicist. But you might open up a can of worms. But there's a lot of different behavioral things. Just like some endothermic mammals, they'll bake themselves in the sun to warm up, and all those other kinds of behavioral tricks that other organisms do to maintain and to increase their body heat.
Yeah.
But I would guess somewhere in the 60s degrees Fahrenheit. And insects are very, very good at determining temperature as well. Fire ants, if we have a rain event and if it gets up into a certain degree in the 70s the next day, that will trigger their fire ant swarms.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of times you'll see a fire ant swarm right after a rain event. And it doesn't even have to be the next day. It could be that afternoon. And I had a friend when I was at Texas A&M doing work on fire ant, female fire ants. And if it was a rain event, you knew that he was out there with a thermometer. And the minute they started swarming, he could catch his fair share of female fire ants.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it seems like these birds got caught up in this fast-moving storm, and by the third day they got to New Mexico. It was a low of 12 in some parts of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and the high never got above 41, 42, and it was just the last straw for a lot of those birds. They just ran out of fuel and perished in huge numbers. So, yeah, so it doesn't help that the refueling is they're reliant on your insects that need to get, you know, warmed up and moving. But anyway, I appreciate you taking my call. I'm honored that y'all picked me up on the line, and I got to be on the other end of the phone. It's a first for me to call in. So love your show.
And you know, Cliff, that's a perfect example of natural selection as well.
Yes.
Because
yes.
You're going to have one percentage of the population that will be able to survive the cold heat and will be able to perhaps more efficiently metabolize what food that they do have in their reserves, and another percentage of the population that won't, and the percentage of the population that can't will not produce viable offspring, and so that's going to be a genetic dead end for that particular species.
Right, that's right. So
very good example.
Well, thank you so much, and I love the show.
And we're only, what, a handful of months away from doing our joint show in the spring.
That's right. That's in April, and maybe we can bring this topic up again in that April episode.
I think that would be something to certainly put on the back burner. Thank you for your call,
right,
Cliff.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call now. We have four lines open at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And Robert from Alexandria. Robert, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi, Dr. Burden.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about murder wasps and a story that I started hearing about them. They were on the news maybe a month ago. And I was carrying the garbage out, and this very large wasp with black and yellow stripes was there, and he was just kind of cruising around, and actually he took a look at me and started to cruise toward me, and so I got back inside, And I thought initially it was a murder wasp. But I don't know if they're down here, if they've been reported down here.
They have not been reported to be down here. And if you, it's easy to tell some of the local wasps from the, what they're calling the murder hornet. And that is because they have a very large yellow-faced head. And we don't have anything around here that looks like that. And if you did see them, it was just by accident, because they're going to favor what they murder is not humans, but what they murder are honeybees. And they and they will pop the head of the honeybees off and consume that, because it tends to be very high in energy. And that's because that's part of where some of the brain material is, and it's got a high lipid fat content to it. And we all know that fats contain more energy than carbohydrates and proteins. And but they're not here in the southern part of the United States as well. And what's going to be interesting, and this kind of is a take on what Cliff Shackelford was just saying, they were first noted up in the Oregon and Washington state areas. And I wonder what these forest fires are doing to the populations up there as well.
They're ground dwellers. They're ground nesters, I heard.
I think what you probably saw was a cicada killer. That's the largest hornet wasp-like thing we have. And they're not aggressive. And you'll see them, and they'll see you, but you're not what they're looking for, so they just go on. The only way that a cicada killer is ever going to be aggressive to a human being is if you actually try to snatch it with your hand, and then it's going to sting out of defense.
But I think you're right. That's what it was, because I looked it up, and it was kind of a brownish face, not the yellow face.
Brownish face, so, and it is dark and yellow stripes on the body, and they're really, I think they're one of the coolest insects we have here. You know, and the fact that they can, you know, find a cicada, paralyze the cicada, fly with it back to its burrowing nest, drag it in there and lay an egg on it, and so that the immatures actually eat the cicada alive, and of course until it's dead. And a lot of people freak out over them. Every once in a while we'll have a certain population of them on the LSUS campus, and our safety guy has an email that I wrote like years ago, but he keeps it on file, and every time somebody's saying, oh no, there's these terrible wasps outside of the library, he'll shoot that to the campus and say, no, now Dr. Burden says these are cicada wasps and just leave them alone, and da 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 da. And so actually they're a very, very important part of the urban ecosystem. So you did the right thing, Robert, just by letting it do its thing. And you probably could have gone ahead and taken out the trash. It would have been fine.
It got taken out eventually. One other question.
Okay,
let me ask you one other question.
Sure.
One other question. And what's the difference between a wasp and a hornet? Are they two things that mean the same thing or not?
People use them interchangeably, but if you take a look at bees and wasps, they tend to, especially bees are very hairy. Wasps are hairy too, but not as much as the bees. And the hornets have very, very little, if at all, body hair, what we call setae on them. And there's another couple of things dealing with the articulation of the wings to the body. But what I say to people, I don't care if it's a hornet, I don't care if it's a wasp, leave them alone, because if you mess with them, you're going to get stung, and then I have no love to give you. You know. That's my biggest take home message when it comes to wasps and hornets. Just leave them alone. Yeah. You know. In fact, a story that's not well known. Back when I was in college, the year before I graduated, this guy came up to me, Dr. Norman Horner, and said, hey, Burden, why don't you take this entomology class I'm teaching in the fall? And I said, no, I don't think so. And because he goes, why? He goes, because I do not want to be stung. He goes, that is such a small percentage of the insect world. It'll be fine. And so I took that entomology class, and I don't know what would have happened to my life if I hadn't. And so always take an opportunity when you can.
Yeah, you got bit by entomology instead.
I guess you're right. I got bit by the entomology bug. You're absolutely right, Robert. Thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you. It's a great show.
Thank you. Maybe you would have ended up a physicist. You never know.
Oh, my goodness. Take it back.
Okay, I take it back. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have all lines open right now, so you can get right in. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have somebody submit a question over the phone. They didn't want to go online, but they said, Roy from Shreveport wants to know if Dr. Burden has a recommendation for getting rid of drain flies.
Okay, drain flies are oftentimes also called moth flies. They're relatively small, about the size of a grain of rice, except they're circular. They're more circular in shape, and they tend to be dark colored. And one of the reasons that they're called moth flies is because they actually have scales on their wings similar to what moths and butterflies do. And if you have moth flies, it means that you have probably a water condition. And so they're in those drains, probably laying eggs. So I would just take some and make sure my drains are well flushed. Go ahead and take some of the drain cleaner, put those in there to make sure that there's no organic material that's down there fermenting that could be attracting these flies. So the way to control moth flies is to have clean pipes.
There you go.
There you go.
You are listening to What's Bugging You, and all lines are open right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. In the meantime, we've got more photos to go through here. And the next one is actually not of a bug, but it's of a man's leg, and he's got a blister on that leg. And he had written in and sent some photos in last month about a beetle that he had seen. And he took a picture of the spot that appeared on his leg after one of these critters had crawled on his leg, and he wanted to know whether or not this could be from a false blister beetle.
Well, like I said, last month when we were talking about these, one thing that makes blister beetles, even false blister beetles, called blister beetles is because they produce a chemical called cantharidin that will cause skin irritation and sometimes to the point of, you know, causing a blister to form. The best thing people can do is just bandage it so secondary infection doesn't occur. Now, I'm a PhD, not an MD, but everybody knows that sometimes if you have wounds, if the more you mess with them, the more likely you're going to get a secondary bacterial infection in there. So just treat it, sanitize it, and cover it, and eventually it'll heal. If it itches a lot, just use a topical anti-itch cream on it, and that should take care of it.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist. All lines are open now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Our next photograph sent in from the Johnsons up in El Dorado, I'm sorry, Ben and Cheryl Johnson. And this is of their porch, and it is just covered with moss. And they kind of wanted to know. They said they are a great fan of the show and very much appreciate you taking the time for this inquiry. These moths are bugging us. Picks
yeah.
from about 5 a.m. in the morning on their front porch. Why more of them this year? Harmful? Asking, are they harmful? Indicative of some problem? They want to know what type of moth it is, and they appreciate it.
Well, I didn't see a close-up of the moths, but just by their general size, there is a family of moths that we call noctuid moths, and they have all kinds of small, brown, inconspicuous moths, and some of them are agricultural pests. The corn earworm is in this family. The little caterpillar that you see in an ear of corn when you're starting to shuck it. The tobacco budworm is in this family. It also attacks cotton. And one of the questions I asked the Johnsons is if they lived anywhere where there our agricultural fields, and are they planting something different this year than what they planted in other years? Because the crop might be attracting more of these and producing more of these. And they said no, that that wasn't the case at all. And so why they were attracted to this particular house, to this particular porch, I have no idea. But it's something that I will certainly keep on the back burner of my mind, because once I see something and I don't have a plausible explanation for it, it plagues me. Mm. And so I will find out. I will investigate this further. And a lot of times if people find organisms and they're sending in a picture, if they could also send me a specimen, I just send it to Beverly Burden, Department of Biological Sciences, LSUS, Shreveport, and the zip for the university is 71115. And I've had people take send me index cards with insects taped to them. There's all kinds of ways to do that, but whatever's more convenient for you. Sometimes that will allow me to get a better clue as to the actual insect and the actual insect and the type of moth these are. In addition, if you are taking pictures of things, now this has bricks, it has molding, I can tell that gives me a reference of the size of these moths. Right. But if you could lay down a quarter or something that gives me a size reference, that's always extremely helpful as well. And so luckily they were just a nuisance. You know, they weren't doing anything. They were just a nuisance to the Johnsons and a curiosity aspect for them. And we talked about lighting. We know moths are attracted to lights and to rule out other things as well. So very interesting.
So keeping your light off at night would probably, you know, help to deter them from, you know, landing all over your porch.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, there you go.
In fact, when I was an undergraduate making my insect collection, I would guess that probably 70% of my insect collections were collected off of my mama's front porch.
There you go.
I spent a lot of time at night out there on my mama's front porch.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go to one more picture before we get to our next call. And we're going to remind you, you are listening to What's Bugging You. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Lines are open right now. And this little guy was eating a friend of mine in Florida plants, and she was not particularly happy about that. What kind of a grasshopper is this? Obviously a grasshopper and a very good picture of it.
Well, I would also remind those listening, if they do want to call in, the clock is ticking.
There you go.
We're over halfway through the hour, and so if they want to get in, they need to call. This is called a lubber, L-U-B-B-E-R grasshopper. It's in a completely different family than our normal grasshoppers. And one thing that makes this unique is the size of it. It's one of the largest grasshoppers in the southeast part of the United States. And it's normally very black and red. You can see the red tint there on the wings. And they have what we call truncated or reduced wings. Those are very, very small wings on a big, big grasshopper. All grasshoppers are plant feeders. They're all what we call herbivores. And they have very, very strong mandibles. And I happen to be very, very fond of grasshoppers. I don't know why. I just love them. And you can notice that prothorax, it almost acts like a shield that's covering right behind the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And that yellow structure on there is basically its top lip. And then the structures right below that are the mandibles. And those are the ones that are, they actually look like little teeth.
Yeah.
They're indented. And I don't know why somebody did a study like this. I don't have any idea. But somebody did a study that says that you can actually take and measure the reduction in the aspects of the mandible to determine the age. And see, kind of like looking at horse teeth. You can always tell the age of a horse by how the teeth are ground down. And so you can do the same thing with a grasshopper. So instead of don't look a gift horse in the mouth, I guess you shouldn't look a grasshopper in the mouth as well. But it's a lubber grasshopper, and you don't find them very often. But I don't know why, they just happen to be in low populations, but we get them in the collection from time to time. It's one of those things that, you know, my students find them and I can't. Yeah. I don't know why. It just, luck, there random luck.
Yeah, a lot of it is luck out there. Most of life is luck, yeah. Actually. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we have lines open right now, and you can get a call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our next caller now, and this is Kevin from Shreveport. Kevin, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
I have a question about an ultraviolet blue light that I have on my back patio to help control mosquitoes, and I'm wondering, am I killing good insects with that light, and should I stop using it?
No, go ahead and use it. If it does happen to attract some beneficials, it's going to be such a teeny tiny percentage of their total population that you won't be influencing their effectiveness at all.
Great. Thank you.
What else you got? That was it?
Oh, I did have another question.
Okay.
I have another question. Occasionally when I'm mowing the grass in my backyard, I find these tiny, what I would call micro-sized wasps flying around in swarms, and I can't figure out what they are or where they live.
Most micro, very, very, very small wasps lay eggs on other insects, and so they're actually... they're parasites. The immatures are parasites to other insects. So whatever is in your grass, probably caterpillars and some other things that you probably don't see, they're attracted to that, and they're laying their eggs on there, and the eggs will burrow into that insect and eat it alive. How cool is that? Yeah.
Interesting to know. Now I have answers.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Let Hollywood pick up on that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have a question submitted via phone, but they didn't want to go online. Elizabeth from Jefferson saw a huge horsefly about an inch and a half long. She has a friend from Canada that says that horseflies up there are big and are called black flies. Could what Elizabeth saw be one of those?
No. Black flies are completely different than horseflies. And although they can get rather large, they're not going to even come close to the size of horseflies. Black flies to the north are like mosquitoes to the south. They can bite, but more of anything, they occur in such dense populations that they're nuisance flies more than anything else. And that's why a lot of people that live in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan don't like to go to the woods in certain times of the year because of the black flies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the horsefly, the Elizabeth, an inch and a half is complete. I wouldn't say inch and a half, but at least an inch is not unusual for the size of them. You can always tell a horsefly if you look at it from the top, the back of the head is concaved and the front of the head is convexed. And so they have that very characteristically shaped head. They also have very unique eyes. But most of the time, all predators will have big eyes because they have to find their prey that way. And horseflies can inflict an extremely painful bite.
Mm-hmm.
They have a mouth part that would be more like a dagger or a sword. And not good. I respect them. If there was one out in the yard, I'd just go inside until maybe it decides to go somewhere else.
Yeah, and they've been bitten by or stung by those, whatever you want to call it, many
bitten.
Times, and they are painful. So,
yeah, fire ants sting. Most flies bite.
Yes, indeed. All right, and we do have a couple of calls online. We're going to go from David from the Piney Woods area right now. David, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, at night, I have a little wood shop that I like to work in and do things after I get home and kind of relax. I'm having trouble with, looks like big brown I call them wood roaches, and I was wanting to know if there's anything I could do to control them without using harsh chemicals or anything.
Well, if they are a type of a wood roach, and that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that there's more species of roach that don't like to live with humans than species of roaches that like to live with humans. And one of the best roach inorganic, non-pesticide-like thing to use is boric acid. You can get it almost anywhere. And it'll might say roach killer boric acid. And spread it around where you know that the roaches are running. Oftentimes, roaches are what we call positive thigmotactic, which means that they like to be part of their body rubbing surfaces. That's why oftentimes you'll see roaches going around the edge of a wall rather than in the middle of the floor. And spread that boric acid around. It's safe for pets, but the insects will get it, the roaches will get it on their legs and the underside of their body, on their antenna, and it causes an irritation to them, so they'll lick it off, and once the boric acid gets into the stomach, it blows small holes in the stomach, and the roach will die a slow and painful death. Boric acid is the way to go.
All right. Well, I just like to get them out of my wood shop.
Yeah.
And do it a safe way, you know. I do have pets, and I didn't want to do nothing that would harm
my pets. It's fine for your pets. Don't worry about that. Boric acid.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, David. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have one more caller online, Becky from Shreveport. You're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
What's bothering us this summer was leaf-footed bugs on our tomato plant.
Yes.
And, I mean, we've plucked them off and squashed them. We've vacuumed them off with a shop vac. Is there something that can kill them pesticide-wise that's not extremely toxic to people?
Yeah, what I would suggest to you, Becky, is good. First of all, good for you to know that they're called leaf-footed bugs. And let me explain that to the people that are listening. And in fact, I wanted to show one of these to Dr. Helen Taylor the other day. And someone came along and washed and flushed it up. And I couldn't get to show it to her. The back legs in the area that we call the tibia, they are enlarged and flattened areas that actually do look like a leaf. And that's why they're called leaf-footed bugs. And they can build up in high enough populations to become pests in home gardens. And, Becky, what I'm going to suggest that you do, that you go to wherever you like to purchase your insecticides from, and you look at the active ingredient. And the active ingredient should end in the suffix THRIN, like pyrethrin, bifenthrin, cyhalothrin. And that is non-toxic to a lot of the vertebrates that you'll have around there. It kind of keys in on the insects. And it would be a good knockdown, environmental-friendly way. More so than 7-Dust or Malathion. Get a pyrethrin. Make sure it ends in the suffix THRIN.
And I was afraid of using pesticide on tomatoes because of bees, but then someone the other day told me that bees don't pollinate tomatoes. Is that true?
Yeah, tomatoes are wind pollen. Are wind pollinated. So
okay.
Yeah, you can go ahead and use that on the. But in every pesticide, it'll tell you a residual date, like how long it should last on the plant. And then if you do happen to get the spray on the fruit, if the fruit isn't ripened, then you probably have enough days to will it will automatically degrade with the sun. But just to be sure, and I'm sure you do this anyway, when you bring your tomatoes in the house, you give them a good rinse.
Yes, and it truly was amazing how fast they multiply. And the immatures, there were so many immatures, and we, you know, they're harder to vacuum because they became very savvy to the vacuum cleaner noise.
That's interesting. I'm not surprised, though. Insects are so resistant and so resilient. You know, the minute we think we have one up on them, they figure something else out. They're just amazing.
Yes, they would go around. They would hide behind things.
Mm-hmm.
It was annoying. But thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we have all lines open right now and just about 10 minutes left, so you can get right in. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, we've got a few more photos to go through that were sent in. This one was from Regina Blackwell from Hampton, Virginia. And she got stung by this sucker and wanted to know exactly what kind of critter it was.
That's just your typical yellow jacket. And they can be aggressive if threatened. And so, unfortunately, I was stung by a mahogany wasp over the summer, and it took me a week before the soreness of that cleared up. Now, one thing that I was telling Bill a month or two ago, that with a lot of your wasps, if you look at them from the top, right behind the head, there will be a structure that's separated from the rest of the thorax. The thorax is the part that the legs are attached to. It may be very wide, it may be very thin, but it will look like an upside down U. And if it has that upside down U, then it's in the vespid family. And anything in the vespid family should be avoided at all costs. Well, not at all costs, but, you know, avoid it if you can.
Now, these look different than the yellow jackets I grew up with in Ohio, which are a little plumper, a little shorter, and much fuzzier.
I'd have to see one, Bill.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll have to go home and get one then.
Okay.
There you go.
Just run up to Ohio and get one.
Right, yeah, happens every day. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And now we have this little critter sent in from Julie Ramsey Campbell from over in Wascom. And this is a very nice photograph of a very interesting looking critter.
These are absolutely beautiful. They're reddish, yellowish, greenish, colored, very shiny. These are called rainbow scarabs. This is a female because she doesn't have a horn on her head. The males will have a horn on their head, and they are part of the dung beetle group. There are many scarabs that are classified as dung beetles, and even within a dung beetle group, there are different ways that those are classified too. This particular beetle happens to be what they call an excavating dung beetle, and the adults and the immatures both eat dung, and they will take a pile of dung and kind of excavate the soil underneath of it until almost to the point where the soil is buried, and then they'll create tunnels, and they'll ball up the dung in what's called a brood ball, and take it down one of the tunnels and lay eggs on it, and then the immatures will feed on that dung, pupate, and then emerge as adults. And so that's called the rainbow beetle, one of the most beautiful insects that we have in this group. Yeah. And you might think, oh, look how pretty. Oh, no, it eats dung. And then, you know, but it's a pretty dung-eating beetle.
Well, somebody's got to eat that stuff.
There you go.
And it's not me.
If it wasn't for them, then we'd be
knee-deep in
knee-deep.
Yeah, there
in
you
dung.
Go.
Yep.
Now, the next one I happened to wander upon taking out my trash one night, and he was just right there in the pathway. And he was crawling slow enough that I could go in and get my camera and come back outside and get him. And what is this? This is some kind of a beetle.
These tend to be rather large. A lot of beetles in this group, they're called, they're pretty small. But some of the larger beetles are in this group. They're called ground beetles.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the family Carabidae. And there's a lot of things that crawl on the ground. They're predators. But if you take a look at the picture that you took, Bill, if you see the antenna extending out like in a V, very wide V-shaped pattern, inside at the bottom of the V are the mandibles. Mm-hmm. And these mandibles are projecting forward. And we call this pronathus because they're projecting forward. And so as they're crawling around the ground, their mandibles are set and ready to attack and to grab onto whatever they can grab on to.
Well, he was hunting on the concrete. There wasn't much there. So
yeah.
He was crawling over towards the box, and I tried to get a couple of photos. The next photo is of, again, that velvet ant that Elizabeth Scoff had sent in. And finally, well, we've got two more here. And this one, Alan Dyson just posted this the other day on Facebook. And Alan is the host of the Shreveport House Concert Series here in Shreveport, and well-known musician and artist. And he caught this baby outside, and this is a wonderful photograph of a type of dragonfly, I assume, but don't know what kind it is.
Yeah, it's called the green darner. It's in a family called Ashnides, and dragonflies always hold their wings horizontally from the body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you did have some other pictures of damselflies that you had sent me this month as well, but they tend to, dragonflies will have a very, very robust body. If you look at the head, that dark color is all eyes, and the eyes of insects are called compound eyes, and that's because they're composed of smaller units called omatidia, and you can even see that there's like a little suture line between the left half and the right half, and that's separating the left eye from the round eye. So I would say about 70% of the head of a dragonfly is nothing but eyes. The other percent of the head are nothing but mandibles, mouth parts to grab and eat things. They will grab and eat things, what we call on the fly. And the other cool things about dragonflies, this picture doesn't really show it, but notice the relatively long legs on that body.
Mm-hmm.
While they're flying, they will take those legs and arrange them in almost a basket-like formation.
Hmm.
And so it almost works as a net as they're flying around and they run across another flying insect. They can capture it in that basket and then attack it and eat it. They'll bring it back up to the mouth and eat it. And whether it's a male or a female, that's hard to say from this photograph. But the thing about dragonflies is that if you watch a dragonfly long enough, they fly in a certain pattern. It's a hunting pattern, and they'll go from this area to that area and then back over here. And I have so much fun with my students when I take them out to catch dragonflies. They'll be running crazy through the pastures and through the fields trying to catch a dragonfly. And I'll just watch one, and I'll stand perfectly still, and then I will maneuver myself. And when it's flying that pattern, I'll maneuver myself so I'm right in their path of their pattern, and snatch one up. And here I am, not even running or anything. Look, guys, I caught a dragon. How'd you do that? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to know their behavior. And so... and that comes from just being very, very observant. And that's a cool thing. If anything, there has been some bright moments to social isolation during the pandemic, and that people are getting out into nature more and more. They're going out for walks. They're noticing the world around them more and more, rather than just be glued to the TV all the time.
Indeed.
You know, I tell kids, go out and play, go out and play, go out and play.
Okay, we've got one more online submitted question, and that was from caller Alex, who wants to know about the rather new termite. They couldn't quite get the spelling out there, Vermosa, but I believe that's the Formosa termite.
Yeah, that's the Formosa termite, and it's been around for over 25 years, so it's really nothing new. They have larger colonies. They are an invasive species. They are not native to the United States. They are native to Asia. And a lot of people don't know that Taiwan used to be called Formosa.
Mm-hmm.
And they have much, much larger colonies so that they can do a lot more damage to wood structures. But even scarier, they will actually feed on living wood, where the native termites only feed on dead wood. And so that makes them much, much, much more of a threat. And so that's the Formosa termite, yes.
And what is unique about them, I guess, is the question. Is it that they eat on, living wood?
Yeah, the two things that I mentioned. One is that they will eat on living trees. That's no good. And they have just larger colonies, you know, by the fold of 10. So, you know, instead of having 100 to a colony, they'll have 1,000 to a colony. Or instead of having 1,000 to a colony, they'll have 10,000 to a colony. Mm-hmm. And so it just makes them a lot more damage-causing.
And damaging houses, too, I presume.
They'll feed on both, yes.
Yeah, it's a major problem.
25 years ago, they started a huge formation termite project down in the French Quarter of New Orleans because they were found down there. And, of course, everybody knows that we have a lot of fine historical structures that must be preserved. Right. And so a lot of they instigated an underground monitoring system that if you walk along the streets of the quarter, you'll find these, you'll see these little round discs, and they're basically sampling for most termites there.
There you go. Well, Dr. Burden, we've wrapped up another show of What's Bugging You. I want to thank you for joining us again.
No problem. My pleasure.
And you have been listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We'd like to thank everyone who called in tonight, and we ask you to join us for the next edition of What's Bugging You here on Red River Radio, which is going to be a 1 week later than normal, Tuesday, October 27th. And the next edition of Bird Calls will be 1 week later than normal, Tuesday, October 20th. This has been What's Bugging You with help from Wally Derleth tonight. The producers are Beverly Burden and Bill Beckett. And this is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Camden, Magnolia, KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, KTYK, Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next.